Hey Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause the motherfucker's 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
Hello everybody, and thanks for tuning in to episode 13 of the Joe Prano podcast. Before we get to my guest today, I just want to get some business out of the way. First of all, and most importantly, if you're in the Southern California area, please check out my Facebook page, my Joe Prano Comedy, or my Instagram for the details about the November 4th show in the main room at the Comedy Store. It's going to be myself, Eddie Ift, Lachlan Patterson, Andrew Norelli, Chad Goes Deep, and Monty Franklin, all surfers, all comedians. It's Comedy Wipeout. It's a show to support the Save the Waves Foundation, which is a charity that supports taking care of the ecosystem on coastlines, on and around coastlines around the world. It's a great charity. It's going to be a great night of comedy. We're going to do our regular jokes. We're going to do some surf jokes. It's going to be a white guys who surf bonanza. If you're in LA, if you're around LA, if you're going to be visiting LA at the time, November 4th, it's for a great cause. Who doesn't love the ocean? Come to the show and enjoy. It's going to be great. It's going to be a fantastic night of comedy. If you want to see me live, go to joeprano.com. Check out my calendar. I will be up in the Bay Area in November. I am building some shows around the Giants visiting the 49ers for Monday Night Football, which could be a game between two severely last place teams at that point. But it's already on the books. So come see me in Oakland at Laugh City. Come see me at the Throckmorton Theater in Marin if you're a Bay Area listener. Or just go to joeprano.com and see if I'm coming to a town near you. I'll also be in Tahoe in December, back at Harvey's Casino. I love going to Tahoe. It's become one of my favorite shows to do, the improv at Harvey's. So if you're a Reno Tahoe person, check that out and get some tickets to that. Also, if you want to support the show, as always, rate, review, and subscribe to it. I can't imagine that you're listening to this if you're not subscribed. But if you're not, please subscribe and leave a review. It's super helpful. We're still only 13 episodes into this. We are trying to get, we, the royal we, are trying to get this show really off the ground still. And all the support has been fantastic. I love all the feedback about the guests I've had, about guests I should have. Feel free to slide into my DMs on Twitter at Fix Your Life, on Instagram at Joe Prano, on Facebook, Joe Prano Comedy, or on Patreon. Messages from patrons take the highest priority, as you people are supporting this show by listening and also financially. So if you want to be a part of those folks who are the first wave of suggestions and requests that get read, go to patreon.com/Joe Prano and support on a monthly basis. $1, $2, doesn't matter. It all adds up and I appreciate it. Send me a message. Let me know what you want to hear. Let me know what you like. Let me know what you don't like. The feedback from last episode with fitness guru Duffy Gaver has been fantastic. And as sort of a flip side to that conversation, one of the reasons that I need some fitness advice in my life is because a lot of people who know me know that I enjoy food. I don't say that in a way like I'm super overweight, like I enjoy food. But I've, being from an Italian family, having family dinners and food and cooking and enjoying, you know, my family's Italian recipes and grandma's meatballs and all the stuff that you would think an Italian would do. I have always enjoyed food. I've always enjoyed sitting around the table with friends and family. It's where, you know, everything in a family and a friend group really happens, is around the kitchen, around the dinner table, around a bar, you know, consuming and enjoying life through food and wine and beer and all that stuff. And I hate the word foodie. I will never call myself a foodie, but I guess by definition I am a foodie. I seek good food. I enjoy finding new restaurants. I enjoy discovering delicious food. I like discovering, you know, under the radar places and hidden gems. And I enjoy going out, especially with friends and family, and enjoying a fantastic meal. And this episode is built around that love. When I was living in Brooklyn, I lived in Brooklyn from 2003 to 2010 before I moved out here to Los Angeles. There was a time when I was going around and Brooklyn was this happening, exciting place where new restaurants and bars and nightlife were popping up every day. And I enjoyed discovering new places to eat. And one time my now ex-girlfriend and I strolled into a restaurant, and it was a Vietnamese restaurant, and you'll hear me talk about it at length on this episode, but our visit to that restaurant changed my life, not just in a culinary way, but also in, it truly changed my life in that we loved it so much that my girlfriend and I ended up going there literally every Friday and eating the same meal. It became a weekly tradition for us. This is how we're going to kick off our weekend. We're going to, you know, take off our work clothes on Friday. We're going to go to Silent H and we're going to have the same dish. And then we're going to go out and have some drinks after. And then the weekend is here. Saturday is a fun day. Sunday's, you know, football or brunch or whatever. And then right back into the week. This was the place that we started every weekend for a couple of years. And the reason we did that was, one, the food was so good, and two, the owner and chef of the restaurant was such a kind and warm and welcoming figure that we could not only go into this restaurant on Friday night and have this person take care of us in a food sense, but he would come out and make sure everything's okay and make sure we're having a good time and make sure we knew what wine to pair with stuff or what beer to pair with stuff or what, you know, dessert we should try or what special, you know, appetizer we should mix in with our usual order, because the entree never changed. It was always the black peppercorn pork chop, and it's still one of my favorite dishes that I've ever had, and I'm not sure that I'll ever change from a taste factor and from an emotional factor. It meant something. It meant the weekend was here. Eat that pork chop and then enjoy some time off. And my guest today is the chef and owner of that restaurant, which is now closed. It was called Silent H, as I said, in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And the chef and owner's name was Vin Nguyen. And the Silent H was because he has a silent H at the end of his name, Vin, V-I-N-H. And we became friends. And I've known him probably about 10 years now. And I've always, as he says in this episode, fanboyed out over his food. I've just always loved everything he's put together, and have sought it out. After Silent H closed, he sort of disappeared, traveling the world on his culinary adventures. But when he came back and he was working in another restaurant, I made sure when I was back in New York, I went there. And then now he's in Los Angeles, and he's fixing to open another place, Stay Lucky, which will be Chinese comfort food, which he is testing around right now. He's perfecting his menu for the next place, and he's doing that at the Mandrake, which is a bar in Los Angeles. Every Thursday night, he's doing a little backyard pop-up there where he's testing and serving a lot of the items that will hopefully be on the menu of his new place. And I wanted to sit down with Vin and talk about his, you know, life in food and his career in the restaurant business, and how he got started in the first place, how Silent H came about, how he's explored food since then, and what brought him to back to Los Angeles, where he's sort of from originally, and why he now is pursuing this different genre of food, and what the new restaurant's going to be about. And like I said, I don't enjoy calling myself a foodie, but I know nothing about cooking. I've got 12 maybe Italian family recipes that I've sort of mastered. I also make a mean bowl of chili, if you ask me, and I crush breakfast from time to time. But I enjoy cooking. I wish I did it more. I wish I did it better. But I love eating, and I love drinking, and I love doing it in a great environment. I like to travel for food. I like to make eating food an experience. I love finding a great place, and Vin's old restaurant and hopefully his next restaurant are some of the favorite places that I've ever eaten. And I wanted to just talk to him about those places and his food and just food in general and food culture in general. So I hope you guys enjoy the show. It's sort of a, I can say it's sort of a sister piece to the last episode. Last episode's about me getting in shape because I just love to eat too much. And this is a conversation about the stuff I love to eat and the people who prepare it. And I hope you guys enjoy. This is my conversation with Vin about everything food. Enjoy, everybody. And hopefully at the end, if you're anything like me, your mouth will be watering and you'll be hungry and you'll say, damn, I got to try these dumplings that he's talking about. If you are saying that at the end of this conversation, the first thing I want you to do, I'll actually do it now. Pause the episode. Pause it right now before you start. I promise you won't regret it. Follow Vin on Instagram. Eat, drink, stay lucky. At eat, drink, stay lucky. Stay Lucky is the name of the project that he's working on now. And the Instagram, at eat, drink, stay lucky, is just going to be a visual bonanza of the dumplings and wontons and chicken wings and all the things that he's making for Stay Lucky. And as we talk about, social media is so important in the food world these days. As we all know, seeing people take pictures of their omelet, hashtag blessed, hashtag so blessed, hashtag omelet. It's so important. So even if you're not in Los Angeles, follow at eat, drink, stay lucky, and you can see what kind of dumplings and Chinese food that you can get if you visit Los Angeles, but also what the dumplings wherever you live should look like. So enjoy the episode. Well, thanks for having me over to your place, buddy.
Thanks, man. Yeah, you're welcome here anytime.
So what neighborhood are we in? Like, where would I say I am right now?
Oh, this is definitely Lemaire Park. The only experience I had with Lemaire Park before this was, I think, back in 2001. We used to go to Babe and Ricky's Inn out here, and it was like a blues club. And I think Babe was like in her 60s or late 60s or something. We'd go, these college kids, and just go watch these blues bands. And she'd come out and just like steal the show and like climb on the tables And I'd be like, help me up, son. You know, like, help her up. And she like, climbs under your table. She's like, I've been a bad, bad girl. Yeah, that was like LeMaire Park.
And then, that was when you were at UCLA.
UCLA, yeah.
What year did you graduate UCLA?
2001.
So we're basically the same age.
Yeah. I think you're like 6 months. So, yeah, I'm August 79.
Yeah, I'm July 79. So we're a month apart, right, bro. Yeah. So you would have been, so you're at UCLA and that's, and you're coming out here to go to jazz clubs.
Yeah. I mean, it was just like one of those things, like your friends, like, I know of like a really cool show. Let's go check it out. And you just go along for the ride, you know, but I just remember that being like kind of in the hood. And
yeah.
Like the other time we'd come out around this area, we would go to the, I think it was the Crenshaw roller rink, and we'd just go like, skate. So, get fucked up first or whatever, you know, but. Yeah, it was
I'd
fun.
Like to see you roller skate. You gotta send me some video from that.
That's horrible.
We can put it along with the episode. I'll just slow it down to an hour and people can watch
like,
you roller skate.
It's like a giant chopstick like going down the ice or the rink. Yeah.
So you were at UCLA. You're not from California. Where are you from originally?
I was born in Indonesia. My parents, my mom came over with her siblings. And when they were Vietnamese refugees, my mom was pregnant with me. So
you were a refugee baby.
I was a refugee. Yeah, I was born in a refugee camp in Indonesia. And then the short of it is how we came here was we were back then there was like an international like refugee campaign going on, and these different groups throughout the world. Like for us, it was like a Presbyterian church in Clayton, Alabama. They like sponsored our whole family over. So I was born in Indonesia, but then went to Clayton, Alabama. So I have all these pictures of me in Clayton,
that's
Alabama.
That's amazing.
It's like, white people like I've never seen before. And like two of them I would
you
call.
You came to the U.S. and you got the best of America. They took you right to Alabama.
Alabama,
like,
dude.
Home of the free, you know?
Yeah, dude. Like I called these people like Mama and Mr. Jimmy every holiday, like especially Christmas. And like, but I never met them. But they were like, you know. Our sponsors, kind of like my white American parents that I never got a chance to meet because they both have passed. But yeah, crazy. And we were talking about Sayulita earlier.
Yeah, you were just in Sayulita, Mexico.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm wearing a T-shirt that says that I just got today. this is the first time I'm wearing it. So,
is it okay?
Yeah. What are the
chances crazy.
Of that?
Do you think your friends were there at the same on the same weekend?
When you were there last weekend?
Very last.
Yeah, they were there. I was dog sitting for them and house sitting and not doing anything crazy because I was on camera. I think
you're always being watched.
Big Brother was watching.
Yeah. They're probably sitting on the beach in Sayulita having a margarita, watching you sit on their couch with their dogs.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, Alabama to where?
Alabama, and then, you know, there's a Vietnamese, a bunch of Vietnamese people kind of just like gathering in Southern California. So, we're like, oh, we're gonna make the move to California, Southern California. We landed in Hollywood, which is like it's crazy because, yeah. It
was now
like,
we're talking.
Yeah, we're moving
first
on up.
Alabama,
yeah, moving
and then
up.
This is like. The Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, the Vietnamese Beverly Hillbillies, exactly. Yeah,
so. That'll be the sitcom we write about your childhood.
Yeah, it was crazy. So we were like right on Argyle Avenue in Hollywood. I remember the address, like 1954 Argyle. And back then,
and
was,
how old were you when you moved to
I think I
Hollywood?
Was two, like three. I mean, I was three. Yeah, 11 months old when I got to the States. And then we were in Alabama for 2 years. And then, yeah, so about three. And we moved to Hollywood. And it's crazy. It's like I've driven down that street, like, in the last few years. And it's, like, it's all nice.
Yeah.
It wasn't nice back then. Not at all. I mean, there was, like, five to eight of us, depending on the night, in a one-bedroom apartment there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, imagine what coming down this street in 1982 would have been like.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
this
yeah.
must have been.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that. I didn't realize did you grow up in Los Angeles? Did you like,
so
you got high school here?
No. So we never like, for some reason we never stayed at anywhere very long. Just
well, you were a
family.
Refugee baby.
Yeah,
you have to keep moving.
That's like nomadic. I'm like that. Yeah. We didn't move that much, but moved enough. Yeah. So it's Hollywood to for real, the ghetto in Pacoima.
Okay. I have no idea where Pacoima is.
Pacoima is straight up the San Fernando Valley. It's like, ask any Latina my age where it is, and you know, like she'll tell you. I was there in Pacoima for 4 years, and we were like totally fine there and stuff. But there was a drive-by one night, and I heard shots, and then I felt glass on my face. But then when I woke up, the window next to me was totally intact. And I remember being like, oh, I was just dreaming. So I went back to sleep. And then in the morning I woke up and like my mom was like, or no, a few minutes later, my mom woke us all up. It's like, oh, some bullets flew through our house. I was like, what? It's for real. And it turned out it was like these picture frames had like blown out off the wall. And the bullets had gone through like three walls and thankfully missed wow. all of us. Landed in like the metal framing of my closet door, and then my mom was like, "That's it.
We're out of Pacoima."
So they pushed us over to a family friend's house. So you know, I mentioned Mama and Mr. Jimmy earlier in Hollywood. Like, someone of relationship to Clayton, Alabama, lived in Hollywood. Her name was Laura Dotson, and she took care of our family. Help like take me, get me a library card, do all these things like that help get me where I am. And then, so we're really grateful for her too. And then when we got pushed out of Pacoima, we got pushed into the arms of the Kramans, Nicole and Bob. I'm sorry, Kramers, Nicole and Bob Kramer.
And when you say we, who's we?
My brother and I.
Okay, your brother.
My sister was in high school. She was just going to finish high school and then go to college anyway, so she stayed behind in Pacoima, but we got pushed to Woodland Hills. So almost to Beverly Hills.
Like yeah.
And now we're at Woodland Hills.
Yeah.
But yeah, dude, and it was like...
And your brother's older or younger than you?
My brother's older.
Okay.
And like that really influenced him, because I think he's like, he became like an Ivy Leaguer. He went like Dartmouth.
Yeah.
He's like a lawyer now. That's crazy. But yeah, it's like a lot of... just influence just where, what neighborhood you and like the company you keep, right?
Yeah. And then so you stay in Woodland Hills until you go to college here in town?
No, because then my
family, feeling now that I've got most of the timeline, yeah. Like let's fill it in.
All right, cool. Yeah, so the final move was like, you know, moving on up with the like the help of all these other people. Now it was like, oh, we gotta get some independence. So my mom and dad bought a house where they, the only like area I think they could find afford a house, and where there were some Vietnamese people, and that was in like San Bernardino. And so yeah, when they bought a house there.
Is there a big Vietnamese population in San Bernardino?
I think so now for sure. Yeah, there's like a, you know, anywhere where there's like two pho restaurants.
Yeah,
it's, you know, there's a lot of Vietnamese people, and like they don't care. Like they don't care if there's enough space for two. Pho restaurants in three blocks, I'll be like, I'll just open across the street.
Right. Like, we'll figure it out.
We'll figure it out.
We'll get double the Vietnamese population, and then we'll still have the same amount.
We do this, we get three more families on Tuesday.
That's great. And when did you, so you, I mean, you're talking about pho restaurants, which is, because you brought that up, it takes me back to
how we know each other.
Yeah. When I was just walking down the street with my ex-girlfriend in Brooklyn, and we're just looking for a place to eat on a Friday night.
You and Marty, yeah.
Yeah, and we look at, did it say Vietnamese outside Silent H?
I said was it's like, very small. Yeah, it just said Silent H really, and then like my friend Danny helped me design that, and it was like Vietnamese bar and restaurant.
So my initial reaction was like, I'm not feeling it. Like, I don't think I'm in the mood for Vietnamese. Yeah, like, pho. Like, I don't want to do soup right now. And then we looked at the menu, and it was intriguing. And we were like, you know what? Let's just go for it. And when I say like that, I feel like that restaurant, your restaurant, changed my life. It was like the first place that I'd ever felt like, I think we went right into literally eating there every Friday night.
That's how we became friends quickly. And like, you guys are always like smiling when you came in and when you left too. So that was a good sign. But no, I mean, I've never heard you say that. Thank you. I mean, I know, you know, you're always there to support and stuff, but thank you for those kind words.
It was like we went in complete, like I went in almost even like half closed minded and just like sat down, but was like the food we both love to eat, and then we're always looking for like that experience where we can really enjoy something together and say like, man, we did it. You know, we saw a menu and we went in and it was just as good as we could have imagined. And then like, but it became, and never after either have I had a place where then the next Friday we're like, let's just go back there. Yeah. Let's just go back there. Let's go. And then it became like a tradition for us where that was like, we meet up after work on Friday, the week's over. We get to go to Silent H. We get to have a good meal, start drinking, start off our weekend, you know, right? Yeah. Like treat ourselves. And like I said, I had a preconceived notion of Vietnamese food even. And then when I went to Silent H, it was like, wow, this is a whole different, this is like not something I've experienced before. To the point where, we ate the same dish every Friday. Yeah. Like basically in order.
Yeah.
We'd get a salad that you have with like shrimp and pork belly.
Yeah, shrimp and pork belly pie salad.
And then
street toast sometimes.
Yeah, street toast sometimes. The pork chop every time we'd split it. And then, you know, you were always kind enough to like,
you like
offer us a dessert and like give us some good beers. And it was just an experience.
That was the whole point. I mean, I hate to be so agreeable with everything like you said, but like I didn't make pho at my first restaurant because I didn't want people to just like pigeonhole Vietnamese food into just one dish, you know? And that probably wasn't the best business decision. A lot of people like talked about like fuck that place, it doesn't serve pho, or like, I don't know, the chef's like kind of a jerk, he doesn't want to make that. It's like people, you know, you can't make Vietnamese food without making pho. And I was like, well, that's the whole point, because for the same reasons, you know, someone like Joe might walk by on a date and be like, oh, I don't want to eat pho. Like, you know, now they know like, oh, I'm going to look for like grilled pork chops on menus and stuff. I'm going to go look for the street toast. I'm going to go look for the crepes, like all these other things. And even that pork chop dish that you like, my mom and my uncle, like my whole like Vietnamese family, the side of my family, they thought I was crazy. They're like, that's like a peasant dish. That's like something like a 5-year-old kid can make at home. Everyone has like their own palate for it, like the salty, sticky levels of the sauce. But like tet kha, you know, and I told you, like, yeah, you make the sauce, it's like sweet and it's salty and it's syrupy and it's like, you know,
and like it's on a pork chop. It's on. I think there was like, was it cucumbers, rice?
Yeah,
it's just and like a. I think maybe was there a hard-boiled egg involved?
Yeah, yeah.
And like
a tea egg. Yeah.
And it was like you said, we didn't know what we were going to order when we sat down. It's not like we saw that on the menu and said, let's have that. But you know, I actually learned exactly, like, again, there's a reason we're friends, I think. Yeah. It's like we obviously see things in the same way and can kind of come together on that. Obviously, we smoked a joint out the back of your house, you know, like we're... But I came in and, like you said, no pho, and we sat down, and I now know a lot. I didn't know I liked Vietnamese food, and then now I love it, and I've experienced so many different things from your, like, I had no idea that there was a French, you know, influence to Vietnamese food.
Yeah,
you know, you have soup, you're like, yeah, it's soup, you know, and not that I don't like pho, but...
Yeah. Fuck colonialism, but it gave us the banh mi,
right?
You know, like it's just like that's the beauty of food, is that it somehow manages to like flourish in from a source of like misery or sorrow or whatever, or just like poverty. You have like basic necessity, and then from that they're like, oh, we always got to make it like clever or like accessible or easier, and then you all of a sudden you have like these like family recipes of stuff that are actually quite like technical to make. It's like you're caramelizing fish sauce, you know, that sounds like so hard, but no, you just like learn how to make it. Like it's one of the first things you learn when you're in the kitchen as a Vietnamese kid. So yeah, you do have a better understanding now for Vietnamese food. And like, if there's a place I guess we should like try to go down to like Orange County, Santa Ana, and go check out some Vietnamese food together, because that's like one thing that I haven't really got my fix yet since I've moved back to LA, you know.
But you
but
you could do it anytime you want.
It's not the same. Like,
why is it not the same?
You got to ramp up like all that. I mean, I could tomorrow just make some, like the bun sale or something, like one or two dishes for that menu for you guys. Go shop that morning.
But I mean, for yourself, you know what I mean? It's not the same. You'd rather just go out and let somebody else make it.
No, my wife and I are like, we eat rice half the week, but it's like, we'll just like saute some. It's like one pot cooking in this house.
That was something I wanted to talk to you about. We'll come back to where we are now, but something I had on my thing for later was, and I'm glad you mentioned like kind of the simpleness of that. One thing I've noticed about yourself and then other people that are in food that I've been around and like care about food and care about crafting food is like when the restaurant closes for the night, they all just want like a cheeseburger.
Oh, guilty. Yeah.
And they all just want like a slice of pizza. And what is it about? I mean, obviously there's something of just being tired and wanting something simple and easy. But I also feel like the people that I know that create like the most exquisite food to me are the people that also end up liking the simplest things. Yeah. Like when you came to LA for the first time after I'd been here, let's go get something. And you're like, let's go to Johnny's Pastrami.
Yes.
you know what I mean?
Anybody I care about when they come to LA, I offer that up. Seriously.
And that was, I think when I moved out here, I said, where should I go? And that was like on the top of your list as well. It's like, I'm thinking you're going to give me like this, the under the radar, like hipster, like, this guy's doing something with bone marrow you'll never believe. And you're like, go to Johnny's Pastrami. Yeah. Do you see that connection as well of people that like really craft great food, loving the simple pleasures of?
I mean, whether it's like something like brand new, or something that like Johnny's Pastrami has been there, it's kind of like now like a landmark joint. Like I like it because it's, I don't even think it's like that simple, but it's the fact that it just exists, and will exist for another 20 years. I think it's been there around for like 30 years or whatever.
Yeah.
Like Apple Pan. Some of these places in LA, they're insane. They're just going to be there. They're going to outlive us, you know?
Right.
And like, I like just having, being a part of that. And like, I want to take you there and see, it's like, dude, everybody, you know, that works there is like in their 50s and, you know, like everybody's got this rhythm and it's so laid back and the sandwich is so.
And it seems like, you know, you mentioned Johnny's Pastrami, you mentioned Apple Pans. Like there's something amazing about also a place that's not going to do too many things. Yeah. And like you're going for a burger, you're going for pastrami and be like, hey, we're not, no substitutions. Yeah. We're just cranking burgers here. Those people do it the best. They make the best burger.
And so, you know, but there's something like punctual about that. It's like, and so, you know, we know how to fuck with burgers.
Yeah.
Know? So, I mean, that's kind of like a branch that I always try to achieve or reach for, you know, like when I concept my food or whatever, like, so with like Stay Lucky right now, we don't, you know, just to sum it up, it's like comfort Chinese classics. That's it. So if you're fortunate enough to be in China or have a friend that can really, really cook like these dishes, you might not find them anywhere outside of like San Gabriel Valley per se. So
just throw out, you know, what's Chinese comfort food? Give people the dishes.
Dumplings. You know, like there's boiled dumplings, pan-fried dumplings, there's wontons, but dumplings for sure. Noodle dishes, you know. Everybody's like into like dan dan min now. There's like, a really nice trend going on right now for like Taiwanese food. So, Taiwanese food is basically just like all of China's food packaged very nicely, you know. So what we're trying to do with Stay Lucky is still highlight or just like let that region of China folklore and ingredients speak for themselves in like a little unassuming dish. So the wontons that you guys really like, those represent Chengdu to us with the Sichuan peppercorns. And then I was like really lucky this year to, I don't know if you saw my Instagram, I was like with this like famous Chinese chef, Chef Yu Bo.
Yeah.
And I don't even know how this happened. My friend dropped a good word for me. It's like, this Finn's like my brother. He's in Chengdu. If you're around, take him to lunch or dinner or something. And this master chef, it's like, okay. It's like, he like gets in touch with me over WeChat. And it's like, have your concierge at your hotel call me, and I'll arrange to pick you up. Like, oh my God, I'm waking up my partners, dude, this guy's gonna like hook it up, man, and like give us an adventure. This is crazy. Wake up. So like we all scramble down, take this train four stops to his train stop, and his wife and him pick us up in a SUV, and they take us to like the wet market, like the farmer's market.
What's like, the wet market? Why wet market?
Because like the difference between farmers markets and stuff is like a wet market, they'll have everything like,
and everything's
your
wet.
Seafood, yeah, but they'll like be butchering the animals like on the streets, and then there'll be like one block that's just like all dry chilies, and another, and you turn the corner and it's like all like noodles hanging in the windows and stuff, and it's like where you go get like this artisanal like crazy good stuff. And he bought us like tofu, and he bought like all this stuff, and he like introduced me to all these ingredients, right? Who does this for like perfect stranger? And then he like, his wife's like, all right, sorry guys, so sorry. Like they're like, eat these snacks. She's like, I got to split up from you guys so I can go shopping, get some fish and some other things that are a little bit further away. But I'll come back and pick you up, and then we'll go home and make you lunch. I was like, what? They're like shopping. Not only giving us a tour, like eat this, but they're like now like shopping to fix us like what the chef thought was like two quintessential dishes of Chengdu that he like loves.
What is Chengdu?
Chengdu is just like the city, you know, and they're known for like their Sichuan cuisine.
Okay.
So Sichuan is like really big right now because it's like mala, like, oh, the hot and like the spice and numbing effect of the Sichuan peppercorn. So, yeah. Anyway, so he like was like he came to my first pop up and was like, "Yeah, your food looks really pretty," which is like a very polite way to diss your food, yeah. You know. But he like sat through like he like drove out here and like he sat through the whole meal and he tried everything. And then like at the end, like before they left, he was like, oh, can you translate for me? And like his, my partner's girlfriend is translating, and she's basically saying like, "Yo, man, your sauces are okay. The only way they're gonna be good is like you gotta like slap people in the face with the flavor." I was like, "Yeah, but I think it's spicy enough." And it's like, "Spicy enough for what? Like the American or the Western palate?" And it's like, "No, who cares if they sweat when they eat it? Like, if it's spicy, they'll remember it."
Wow.
So. And then, like, that wasn't enough for him. Like, the next time I saw him, he was, like, carrying a jar of hot sauce for me. It's like, a big fucking ass, like, mason jar of chili oil. And, like, I have some. We can try it later. You can just, like, kiss it.
Yeah.
And your lip will, like, burn for, like.
And was he suggesting that you just put that in everything?
He was basically, like. He was like, well, even just try your chili oil and taste mine. It's like, okay, yours. But it wasn't just like once you really taste it. It's always teaching me. So it's like once you taste it and you get over the fact that it's hot, so crazy spicy, you start paying attention to the other nuances. Like so he chars his chilies, you know. It probably gets a little bit spicier too, but like that deep smoky note.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, are you drinking tequila or are you drinking mezcal, you know? And like those back notes are always what he's revered for. And for me to even like have that light bulb go off and like reapproach my sauces and stuff. That's why I think he like, because you've been through like the beginning of this with me too. Like you came to my first time I made one of the first ones where I was making dumplings in LA.
Yeah.
And it's like since then, even just like the last 6 months, you know, it gets better.
Yeah. You can tell that you're basically when you invite people to come out, you're practicing it. You're
yeah.
like,
you're
taking the show on the road and being like, here you go.
Yeah.
And I'm and like that's what's crazy to me is, you know, I'm from a family that cooks and like my, you know, my dad makes great Italian food and,
yeah.
but there isn't to like, home cooked Italian food, there isn't like, that's not, it's just like, let's make a lot of pasta and let's make it really good. But you're having the same thing, mm-hmm. you know, for it's family cooking.
Yeah.
And like, I don't even think about any of that stuff. And until I met you and can watch somebody go through the process of going like, okay, this isn't just like a done dish that was in a recipe book that was handed to me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm creating something
and
it's really fun to watch, and it's really like interesting to watch, and it's great. Like, the best part about watching and experiencing is like, I'm just eating dumplings.
Yeah.
Like the worst dumplings, like, pretty good.
Dude, you know what I mean? You know, once we get a little bit more settled in, we should have you guys just come over and make your own dumplings and cook them yourself. I'll just have this stuff ready for you to throw together, but you could wrap them yourselves.
That's awesome.
Then,
that'd be cool.
you can advocate for the $2.50 I'm going to charge per dumpling later on. They're handmade.
So how does a Vietnamese kid who had a Vietnamese restaurant end up deciding he wants to make Chinese food?
Oh, okay.
You've abandoned your people.
No. Well, first of all, I am half Chinese by ethnicity, I think, because both my parents were half Chinese too. So, and my mom's side of the family, they all still speak Mandarin, which is helpful because my mom can talk to Julie's mom. That's my wife. I don't know. I think you probably know this, but my mom dropped out of school when she was like 8. She's like the eldest, and she had to make some money to help her mom out with her younger siblings, and she had a lot of them. So
at 8, she got called into the workforce.
She got called into the workforce, yeah. And she went to help this older Chinese woman sell Chinese food in Vietnam on the street, like street food. That's why Silent Nature is all about street food. But all my recipes came from my mom. All her recipes did not come from my grandmother. They came from her employer.
Right.
You know, who taught her some sick ass, just clever approaches, ripoffs of whatever dish they can make. You know, to this day, my mom still says crazy stuff. Or she does, she's like, oh, it's Vietnamese spaghetti.
Yeah,
that's how she explains it, and it sounds like a silly thing, but then you eat her food, and it's just an old Vietnamese woman trying to make spaghetti that she tasted at Joe's house.
Right, right. But you're saying as far as an actual dish goes, that's not a thing. It's just a creation.
Yeah, it's just that's my mom solving a problem.
Right.
It's not her trying to be a chef or anything.
Yeah. Now how early did you get into wanting to be a part of food, wanting to do something other than eat it?
It's genetic, dude. I mean, I think my mom's definitely OCD and stuff, you know. So is one of her brothers, and I think that bug definitely hit me. But my mom's always she can't sit still. She's always up in the kitchen, and it's like a cabinet opening, closing. It's like a fridge opening, closing. It's like chop, 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 wash, wash, chop, chop. It's like, what the fuck are you doing? Cooking for 200 people.
Yeah.
You know, but it's just also the other thing that I inherited from her is kind of becoming a cheapskate. The older I get, it's like, I can't waste anything, you know, it's not even nose to tail, you know, counting how many scallions are in the bunch. Shit like that. It's lurking in there. I'm turning to my mom. But yeah, I think
this is the time in our life when that change starts to happen. We're right around 40.
You think people have midlife crises?
It's not even I think if you don't have I think if you have a midlife crisis, you try to not do that, right? I'm gonna get a sports car and be a and go start bungee jumping. And I think people who don't have the crisis just go You know what? My parents actually had it. They knew what they were doing. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like Allie, I was just talking about how she just bought a house and we needed a low maintenance thing for the front yard. I was like, we can't plant any more plants. We can't have grass because I'm like, then we just got to come out here and take care of that. We're already taking care of. And so I was like, we should put a bocce court in.
And, whoa, and smart.
Yeah, we put a bocce
court. In the front yard?
In the front yard.
That's sick.
And it's just like a little, you know, AstroTurf bocce court with some wood on the side. And there's a scoreboard there already. But it's like because my dad had a bocce court in our backyard. And I'm like, yeah, he had it right. Like that on Sunday, why not have people over and drink some wine and throw bocce? I mean, it's just something to do.
Yeah, you can't do that in the Lemire Park. No. You can do it in Venice.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. You probably could though, you know?
Here?
Yeah.
No, man, my neighbor, she takes the trash in for me. Like I'm getting bested by like an 80-year-old woman, man. She's super sweet.
Yeah.
She's like the mayor of this
the block.
Yeah. But it's like, I'm like, Francis, you don't have to take in my trash. Like I was like, I'm like in my pajamas. I'm like, you literally beat me like 20 seconds. I like jump out of my bed when I hear the trash truck and I'm like, oh, here we go. You know, it's like, so I get that. And she's already like, she's got her gloves, her kitchen gloves on.
Oh, she was taking her trash down to the curb for you.
No, she it's her routine. She likes to do it for the whole block. It's like her exercise. Like this lady is crazy. She's so sweet. She's been here forever. Her husband bought the house across the street for $25,000.
That's insane.
Yeah, it's insane. $25,000. And back then, like, it was like so openly racist. Like they wouldn't let people of color buy homes on this block. Her husband had to give a white person like money to buy it for them. And she's like, yeah, they wouldn't let any black people live here. And now the white people want to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got an Asian instead.
Yeah, the gentrification parade just keeps beating its drum. It walks through every neighborhood and then it comes back around.
And then it's funny because like in, I think when we were in New York or in Brooklyn or anywhere, you like, if you ran into an Asian, you would think what, Chinese probably?
It's
predominantly Chinese. I forget, here in this part of LA, it's like a predominantly Korean, right? So the reason I bring this up is because I haven't had a haircut in a while. And one of the other neighbors, she's a little bit younger than Frances, but I think she's in her late 60s, or I'll be nice, early 60s. And she's always out there too. She's like, she thinks my name is Kim. And she always likes to tell me like, oh, when you drove past me the other day and you waved at me, I was like, who's that woman? Who's that? Okay, my name's not Kim, and dude, I'm a dude.
Yeah. You can't be assuming genders these days, first of all. And definitely don't assume wrong.
You used to have super long hair when I met you.
Yeah.
Did you miss it?
Not at all.
Yeah, it's annoying, right?
I think it was just a thing where, like, when you have long hair, it's like, it's just a process to get it there, and then you're like, every time you're like, I don't know if I'm ready to part with it yet. Yeah. But once you do, you're like,
How long can this go on, literally?
Yeah, that's funny. That's like the only time in my life that I ever had crazy long hair. Never before, never after.
Yeah, no, that's still how I remember you, you know, like originally. So it's like, yeah, dude.
That was my like.
Yeah. You got the salt pepper beard now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was my outlaw Brooklyn days when I was a recluse that only went out
to Taku Taku's.
Yeah, to Silent H on Friday night and then drank the rest of the week in lonely bars. So you went to school at UCLA and then your name's not Kim, by the way, it's Vin, and we'll include that with the title of the episode, but it's V-I-N-H.
Yeah.
Is that a full name?
That's the full name.
The full first
Silent
name.
H, yeah. You know?
Yeah, hence Silent H was your first restaurant.
Yeah.
And what made you go to New York? And when you went to New York, did you know that you were going to open a restaurant, or do you know that you just wanted to work in food, or were you in restaurants?
Well, to pay for school, I always worked in restaurants, like waiting tables and whatnot. And then, the first time I really enjoyed, or I felt like I learned anything, or learned from, like, a great deal of knowledge about food and stuff, was at Father's Office for, you know, we've been there for burgers too, right?
Yes.
So Sang was kind of like a hard ass. And, you know, he would give us quizzes like every week on like beers and the menu, like the origin of the cheese, just crazy stuff. And like, I didn't know shit, you know, like I just like 2 years earlier, like I thought the nicest restaurant was like Cheesecake Factory. And like, I remember that my first day there, I was like, yeah, we'll take the something nachos with the Brie cheese. And my date's like, Brie, motherfucker.
This is when you're...
It's like freshman year at UCLA.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So, yeah, so Father's Office kind of like opened my eyes. I was actually at the time supposed to be like, take the MCAT and try to get into med school. Then I would have been like a doctor and like not a starving chef.
Well, you talked about before your brother's a lawyer.
Yeah, my sister's a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was pre-med, but then, yeah, so I was like bartending and having the time of my life, meeting. I was like 21 and I was meeting like so many cool people like that would just like kind of open up to you like after a few beers and like just like, oh, I traveled here, blah, blah, blah. And I think at that point, more so than just like college, my just kind of like working and hearing these stories, my imagination kind of opened up to like leaving the nest. My mom was like a factor and stuff too, though, because I didn't want to. The only reason I left to go to New York was like my mom at that time decided to like move in with my sister. So I was like, otherwise, I was like the youngest, so I was going to stay closest to mom. So, but yeah. I was like working at Father's Office, bartending, learning about food. And then someone's like, dude, if you're going to bartend, you can do that in any city. And I was like, ah, I can.
Yeah.
So I went to New York and I was like, I'll just give it like 6 months or whatever.
So Father's Office, for those folks who are not from Los Angeles, burger joint. There's one, I think we've got the one right here at Helms. Is that the only one? Is that the only restaurant? Father's Office of one location.
No. The original one was Santa Monica, Montana.
Okay.
And then they have the one at Helms Bakery on Venice Boulevard near National.
And they make a burger. You
can't get ketchup with it.
That's I know, the big sticking point for, like, people who are... A lot of L.A. people I know are like, I can get ketchup in and out, fucking. Yeah. Fuck Father's Office.
There was, like, this homeless guy named Chris that used to hang out... the bar, and you know, he would like sneak in and then like use the bathroom to like clean himself up and then leave the bathroom spotless. He was like this like local homeless guy, and used to be like apparently like really talented like jazz musician, and he just kind of just, you know, chooses to be homeless, whatever. But he thought it would be clever to sell ketchup packets to people
on the way in.
So like, I didn't even know about it. And then like someone's like, do you know there's someone selling ketchup outside? I was just like, that's hilarious.
It's incredible.
And then I got, you know, later on the doorman and say, oh yeah, I saw Chris hawking ketchup back. It's so funny, you know, it's like, I think that's, yeah.
And when you look up kind of the, like if you were to Google the best burgers in LA, that'd be on a lot of the lists, a lot of the blogs.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And so that's where you first get interested in like, being in food, like as a profession.
I think like I was just taking notes at that time.
Yeah. But
I kind of feel like because of that experience, you know, I kind of, it kind of paved the way for like what I, bye honey. So embarrassing. You can hear the alarm.
No, that's great.
Yeah, it just kind of...
Got a nice alarm. It talks to you and everything.
It talks to you.
The door is open.
The
door is ajar.
That's what I'm getting to, you know, because the door was ajar for my future.
Yeah, exactly.
So, no.
You know, you were talking about before, like, doctor, lawyer, you're going to take the MCATs. And the reason I wanted to have you on is because I do think... I haven't had anybody that's a chef or anything in food.
Yeah.
But I think that talking to artists... Like, food to me is an art, and your decision to kind of do that is very similar to somebody saying, like, I'm going to be a musician.
Right.
I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to be a comedian. Like, you're going out on your own, and you're saying, like, I got to find my way in this, as opposed to one of the, you know, being a doctor or lawyer. Yeah. It's like, this is the path. millions have done it. This is how you do it.
Yeah.
And I just think that I do think there's a lot in common with that and people that get into food saying, yeah, I want to make food for people, but I also want to, I have to create something that's
right.
different that
yeah.
makes it unique
yeah.
as opposed to like, you could get in food by owning yeah. a McDonald's, but.
Yeah. I think if you look at artists as being anything, like anything you create. Yeah. Yeah.
I also think of it as like when you think of the senses, like music is, you know, your hearing
yeah.
and, you know, movies,
painting,
your
you see,
eye,
yeah,
yeah
you your, like,
your sense of taste and smell is,
yeah,
you know,
totally.
It's just as present. And people, I think too often are just like,
do you think
filling a hunger?
Yeah. Do you think if that's true, do you think, there'll ever be like a market for like offensive food?
Yeah.
It's like, there's like, you know, like, I don't want to say like it's offensive, but there's like noise rock or something super extreme like that. You think people will ever be like,
yeah, yeah, I think you, and I think you should do it. I think you should use that chili that you got and put it in everything and then just play like, you know, German fucking death metal and just blow out people's all of
yeah,
their five senses.
Noisy H.
Yeah. With strobe lights. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, when you go to New York, did you keep bartending? When do you
yeah.
get into, like, how does Silent H happen? Because that's also like, that's the
you
other
know,
thing.
Was, yeah. Right before Silent H, I was at my first job was one of my first jobs in Brooklyn was at Anytime.
Really?
Do you remember Anytime?
Yeah, I do. Of course. When I moved to Brooklyn, it was like the only thing that would deliver
yes.
after whatever time.
They're open all the time.
A block and a half away.
Yeah.
And
my shifts were from 8 p.m. to 8 in the morning.
And you're probably making me fucking, you know, tater tots. And
I was in the kitchen yeah, back then. I was like bartending and managing. But dude, it's just like every day we would just have like to deal with like people that order and pass the fuck out.
Yeah.
And no the delivery guys is calling the restaurant. I'm like, dude, man, it's like, you know, blacklist this guy, man. This is like the fourth time. And it's like,
and it was late night. You know, sandwiches and fries
yeah.
and like, and yeah, it was the only thing in the neighborhood. Yeah. We would order hundreds of dollars
yeah.
of food at $4 an
yeah.
item.
Yeah. That job totally ruined me because like I was super sympathetic for like the stress when like someone orders like $100 worth of food and passes out.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, like after that, I was kind of like the Anytime like off-duty police.
Yeah.
The bar's like, dude, don't fucking leave. I just heard you order Anytime. Like, don't leave the bar yet. Don't go.
When you're out, when you're not working.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. So what year is that that you got to Brooklyn?
Oh, man. I think I got to Brooklyn in like 2003. Yeah.
So that's we basically arrived together.
Yeah.
I arrived to North 6th Street. You were at Anytime.
Yeah.
I was drunk ordering food
yeah.
and
yeah.
not
yeah.
not answering when you came
yeah.
to the door. And then it's only a couple of years later, like my math, right, that
yeah.
you have your own restaurant.
Yeah, 3 years. Yeah. So I was like just working for a catering company in between. And again, just like learning kind of the business end of it, like seeing just like the entirety of an operation. You know, so like going from a place like Father's Office and seeing like something super small, small family, like of bartenders, two or three cooks, you know, small team, small menu, but everybody's got each other's back kind of thing. And then seeing like the catering operations, which is like crazy frenzy of people's like, you know, all these cater waiters that, you know, just work part time. And so like nobody knows what's going on. And they fix everything by just throwing more people on it. Just add more bodies. So yeah, that was in between.
It's the army of
yeah.
food.
And I could have, dude, I was like, even like when you think about like, I didn't get fired, but you know, I got hired to help with the catering aspect of the Rubin Museum of Art. I was like the assistant, food and beverage director there for like a year or so. And, God, this is incredibly boring. No, but the catering company wound up like pulling out from their contract with the museum. So when they pulled out, like I was out of a job,
right?
And that kind of like forced me to open Silent H. something like it just like rushed me. Like,
you're
it
like,
just
well,
like
I don't
shot
have a job. I guess
cannon.
I gotta
yeah,
open a restaurant.
Let me achieve my dream this summer.
Yeah.
And it was like, I swear to God, it was, it started off as like a folder. Like, I like stuff sketched out. I had like menus, like, you know, just dozens and dozens of different types of menus that I wanted to employ. And then like started like, I had like brochures of like ovens and like, oh, there's this $3,000 fridge, the same exact thing for $600, tagging that URL. Like, and it just became this binder, and then it became this backpack. And just, I remember
you were
just
smoking a lot of weed at the time, just Googling.
No, it's like that HBO show, whatever, the weed dealer that goes around. No, I had this backpack, and then I was just sitting at a poker game and stuff. And then people are like, oh, you should just like, just if my friends who are like, you know, kind of older than me, like have been through business and stuff, they're like, hey, you should, you know, look into like leases and stuff, just learn what the market's like, blah, blah, blah. Find out what it is. I was like, square footage, shit, I never had to think about. So this is on good advice of friends too, that I started doing that. And then like, all of a sudden, like, I was like, hey, the old Osnot space is like, it's available, you know? And I walked through it. I was like, dude, it's like so cool right here. Like, I think I could land here.
And I feel like a lot of people walk around and maybe don't have a binder full of stuff, but that's the deal. Like, oh, look at this space and look at what it is. Yeah. And you know, it should be here. Yeah. So, I mean, you'd been plotting a little bit, but like, what's the moment where you're like, okay, I'm actually doing this. Like saying like, I'm renting this space.
It was just this week. Like, actually, I was going to take this other space first because the rent was ridiculous. It was like, I think it was like 18 or maybe like 2,000 a month, right? For this, like, all I wanted out of this space was that it had the duct worked for a hood to go up to the fifth floor or fourth floor or whatever. But it was like, someone had been like, some people had been squatting here and shit. It just looked like a living room and then like a kitchen, a big kitchen in the back. And that place is called Forget About It now. It's like a smoke shop.
Where is that?
It's on Grand and Havemeyer or something okay. Like that right there. But yeah, I really wanted it because it was cheap. And I was like, dude, I could just fucking, you know, serve like 30 people a day and I'll be stoked, you know? And then like I saw the space on North 9th and Barry and I was like, okay, I got to fucking scale this up. You know, can I do like rents like 6,000? 300 or whatever. I was like, can I do 3,000 a day in sales? And it's like, oh fuck, I got to do lunch and dinner, but fuck yeah, like that menu was already there, you know? So I was like, oh, let's just fucking do it.
You went into your bag of menus and you're like, which one fits this price point?
Dude, I was fucking crazy, dude. I was young and dumb and fucking lucky, you know? It's like at $60,000, like mostly from like credit cards and stuff, like 25,000 cash. I borrowed a little bit of money from my family. I opened, opened the restaurant on a shoestring of 60,000. Had my roommates help me like paint
and
stuff. Had
and
my friends help me build stuff.
And this is in the hottest neighborhood in New York at the time. It's like you went for it.
I didn't even know. I mean, it just felt like a place I wanted to be for the next few years. You know, like. I mean, back then I was hanging out with people. I think my friend was like living in the Chinatown. One was in like Lower East Side, Carroll Gardens, you know, but like I had a lot of fun in like Greenpoint and Williamsburg. I know you did too. Of course, everybody did. That's why it became what it is now. You know? But it was like, I knew nothing about the neighborhood. In hindsight, at that time, because what I've learned about that, like the people I've met, the friendships I've had, like from opening that restaurant, have been like just impossible to count or even explore. It's like I was like the happiest years of my life, and it's like 80% of my life I felt like happened on North 9th and Barry at Silent H and then Cafe Colette there, all the way up till. We kind of split part ways. I went to China and you peaced out too.
Yeah. Yeah. So well, when you say in retrospect, like, is that something you open a restaurant and you don't, you know, like I'm the same way. I was there and it just seems like, oh, it's a cheap, cool-ish place to live. And then, like that, like you said, what's happened since, it all kind of happens around you, and you almost don't notice. It's like growing your hair out. But, like, was there a pressure when you open a restaurant in, like, the up-and-coming neighborhood where are people coming in and you have to worry about people reviewing your food and, like, blogging about it? Is that something that was, like, part of owning a restaurant in Brooklyn in the middle of that time?
I wasn't into that scene at all at that time. I'm always like a little bit behind everybody else.
That's why this restaurant we're promoting on a podcast before it's even open.
Yeah.
we're getting you into this social media game before you even have another restaurant.
There's one time I'm ahead. I think just because my friends were like super supportive and like wanted to see me succeed, that kind of just drove me. Like, three of my roommates came to work for me. Like, one of my best friends came and worked for me. Like, I met Michelle and Bonnie, the Vietnamese sisters that helped open Silent H with me. And then later on, my friend Dennis, like, came in and worked with me. So it's like, I never had to, like, I just shook. And, you know, I just kind of shook the trees around me, and like they were very fruitful at the time. So I learned the hard way later on how lucky I was, because it's very hard to like, just come out of the cannons with like a good team and stuff. I'm going to have to go through that now. After living in New York so long, coming back to LA, it's a whole different ball game out here. And, you know, I have less resources, but I'm in a good place. Because, you know, with the credibility of coming from New York and stuff, like, it opens, I feel like, a lot more doors out here in LA too. So I'm super excited to, if we ever find a space.
And you have experience of having done it once before. How do you feel about the phrase, the customer is always right?
The customer is always right. I think so. Yeah, I feel the customer's. I'm really thinking about this.
Because I'm like, I feel like that's a horrible phrase, because I go to restaurants, and I went to your restaurant, and you were the nicest restaurant owner ever, and you'd come out and talk, and we're friends 10 years later. But sometimes you're at a restaurant, and you're having the time of your life, and you're seeing somebody that's just ruining this restaurant's life. Like, this is wrong, that's wrong. Yeah. I want to talk to somebody. I'm sure you must have dealt with just your angry customers in life.
I didn't even know that was a thing. I just thought some people had issues and stuff. But no, I was like super naive. So, you know, people always say things. People always will. Like, when I was cooking at the Indonesian restaurant, Selamat Pagi, we had like an article that came out, and it was like a positive piece about us and the stuff that I was trying to introduce there. I think it was like the Daily News or something, I forget the publication, but just like a nice like small little article. And then all these people responded like, oh, look at his last name, he's a Vietnamese guy, he's like a hack, you know. I'm like, shit, I didn't know I had to be Indonesian to cook Indonesian food for hipsters and in Greenpoint, you know. It's like, my bad, dude. It's like, not a single Indonesian person here. Dude, I had cultural appropriation,
bro. It's a serious crime these days. When you're a restaurant patron, you always, like, I live in fear of the chef, you know, that they're like, don't send this back because they're going to spit.
Gordon Ramsay's going to come out.
Yeah.
Or they're going to spit in your food. Yeah. That's fucking wrong. no, I've never worked with anybody that would.
Did you ever go back into the kitchen pissed off, like, because a customer said, hey, this or that, like, and said, this is bogus?
Yeah, because I really didn't have, like, too many, like, chef mentors, or, like, I didn't, like, formally go, you know, get trained to be a chef. I dropped out of culinary school, so I didn't have like that role model or whatever, or I had like saying, you know, for example, but I was never in the kitchen under a chef. So I was just reactive. And I felt like when I did get called out to table, it was always nerve wracking, whether it was the response was positive or not. You never know, but you're like also really busy. It's stressful in the kitchen. You come out and you got to put your best face on. So when something was negative and stuff, it's like you just own it and stuff, but you always take it personal. And I don't really think I've ever had anyone like be pissed at me to my face, or, you know, say anything like negative to my face. There's always that on like Yelp and whatever.
Right.
Definitely have people that are very supportive and stuff, say stuff. And it's always good to hear. I mean, it's probably like the other currency that keeps us alive in the kitchen, you know, it's just like gratitude. You know, I think there's not a single chef that does it who doesn't do it because they want to please somebody, you know. But yeah, I took things personal, and so like without like.
Do you remember your worst Yelp review? Do you remember what the issue was?
The one that stands out was like the very beginning of Silent Ish. Long story short, she was like, her husband was the author of this post, and he was like basically like, she waited way too long for her summer rolls, and then someone else got theirs before hers. Kind of classic, you know. But it's so like cliche, but it was essentially that, and then
that's every Yelp review, right?
And yeah, but the way his ended was like that I had got it into it with her by saying like, oh, like get that woman like her check, or like I had some attitude, but I was just basically trying to communicate to like my new staff, you know, in a small sea of people, like. It's that person there, like, oh no, like you gave it to the wrong person, give it to her, you know. And you know, it was like the first time we were looking at reviews and stuff, so it kind of was like, you're lying, but who's gonna, you know, it's your word versus mine. But yeah, thanks for trying to like take us down. And I always kind of felt like a takedown, you know, you can't really defend yourself. But and that was the reason I remember this, because I think it was the first negative review we got. And there and behold, like the next night, someone responds, you know, that was a witness and was like, that's not how it went down. And like, he actually knew the guy that posted. It's like, because he was like, Dave, you're always like a dick like this, blah, blah, blah. So he's like calling his friend out, you know.
Yeah, that you had a internet comment war.
Yeah, and I was like, well, it's like. And I was like, dude, asking my staff, did one of you like make this like
yeah.
profile and do that for us? And it's like, because that would have been like genius, but also wrong. But no, it was like a legitimate user was like, no, this guy's like. But the crazy thing is, I also remember this because they went and they almost like copy and pasted their negative review to every site. So it wasn't just what we're talking about, like Yelp or whatever.
Right.
It was like.
They're on TripAdvisor.
I'm going to get you on Eater. Like, they're trying to, like, I don't think Eater was around yet, but, like, all the ones that were out, that review was.
Yeah.
Like, damn,
the guy blasted you.
Fuck. Take me down.
So how long was Silent Age open?
Man, so 2006, like 3 years and change. Yeah.
Silent Age closed, and I was like, well, I got nothing to be in Brooklyn for.
Yeah.
I'm going to Los Angeles.
Yeah. Fucking recession, dude. That hurt. Yeah, I remember, like, just being like, what the fuck, dude? Like, everybody's, like, losing their money. Like, you know, people are, like, their house prices are dropping. Like, the world's just running out of money. And then all of a sudden the phone starts ringing and, like they're like, oh, we have to charge like more for your deliveries. The price of rice is going up. Everybody's shaking me down.
Right.
And then like nobody's coming in except on the weekends. And like you look outside and everyone's going to bars, you know, like people stop spending their money on like eating, but they're still hanging out at bars, which is fine. We just weren't doing well. So I got tired of like.
And you, I remember a counter was some karaoke and just drinks at the bar for a while.
Yeah, we tried everything, guys. It ended with karaoke.
I mean, to me, it's
I need
like,
a gimmick. Guys, come by again.
Yeah, but
on Thursday and join us for karaoke.
But to me, it's like that's why it's you look for a place like that. You know, like everybody Cheers is everybody's favorite show for a reason. You know what I mean? It's nice to go to a place where everybody knows your name.
Exactly.
And
how
who doesn't like karaoke and banh mi? You know what I mean? Like,
there's Joe's gonna fucking sing Beach Boys again.
So 3 years, and then like that's every restaurateur's story. Like no one whose first restaurant works, right?
Oh,
like,
man, I know. Especially it's devastating, but yeah, definitely in New York. Yeah, I could rattle off a few, but I won't. But yeah, some experience is very close to me too. Like yeah, it's very hard. Like I think number one mistake a lot of people I can point out in every instance is just people taking things very personable. I'm sorry, personal. Sorry, and it's hard not to, but it's hard enough to get it all right. It's just with this day and age with New York being so saturated with restaurants and not enough cooks. Like yeah, it's difficult. Look at Wonder's work now. It's like anytime it went from like in 5 years from having like one place that delivered to
everything. Yeah.
50 per neighborhood.
It's crazy. I mean, now you go back and it's an Apple store and a Whole Foods and it's like
crazy.
It's nuts. But, to me, it's like, I look back at the time, the same thing you're talking about the art. Like when I look back to being the starving comedian then and being in Brooklyn, like at the time, it's such a struggle. And the same, I'm sure, opening your first restaurant, like kind of on a whim in Brooklyn, it's such a struggle. But like you said, you look back now and it's like, that's the best time.
Yeah. Thank God for God bless Alligator Lounge.
Right.
Yeah. Places that sustained us through like
just
early adulthood.
Free pizza with a drink.
That's it.
I went the first time I went, talk about a starving artist.
Yeah.
I couldn't.
You ate like two of them, right?
I ate like seven and I threw up a ball of dough on the sidewalk. I threw up just a carb ball.
Baby.
Like my buddy was like,
Daddy.
I was like, I hadn't eaten in 2 days leading up to this. Seven beers, seven pizzas. What am I going to do? Turn down free food?
Ate the equivalent weight of my head. I remember sorry, I just have to describe the pizza that for people that have never been to Alligator Lounge back in the day. The dough was like rolled so thin just to stretch it out, and it was just enough sauce and cheese to qualify
as a pizza.
They're like, we're not going to give you any more.
It was like a bagel bite rolled out to 8 inches.
They were it seemed like they were kind of on the border of being like too cheap with their ingredients, but they were one business. If they were trying to be cheap, they wouldn't have like unlimited.
Yeah. Unlimited free pizzas. So, I know after that, then you traveled a lot and you always worked in food.
Yeah. Since then. Yeah. So, after, leaving New York when I was in Shanghai, I was again, another close friend of mine was like, just come, if you can bartend, like live there, you can live in Shanghai. Tell you what, why don't you come just check it out for like buy one way ticket, check it out for a while. See if you can live here. So I went out there and I was like, okay, I'm going to go back now. But like my last week there, these two guys like approached me on the street. Now they just, two friends that I met there, they basically were like, hey, what would it take for you to come, like, check out our restaurant and see if you can, like, turn it around? So I went, they had, like, this little cafe. They had, like, a lifestyle shop in the front, like, that sold, like, vintage Nikes or, like, you know, it's like hip-hop sneaker freak stuff. And, like, the one of the guys was, like, China's, like, they call him the godfather of hip hop. He's like this like infamous DJ. So like they had this cute little cafe, this dope little space, but like nobody was coming in. So I was just like, yeah, you probably have to change some stuff, but yeah, if you can like float me a visa and a place to stay and pay me, I'll come back out, you know, So I came 6 months, turned into 2.5 years. I met my wife, Julie, there.
And what's your approach to fixing it?
Well, I was like, dude, I'm going to be here for 6 months. I have to like, I have 6 months to like learn the ins and outs, come up with an idea and bounce. And I'm not going to be here. So one of the things I realized when I was living there was like the staff, no one, it was real, or just the pool of employees you could find. Nobody was really invested into learning about a restaurant because eventually they'll have their own one day or something. Everybody's kind of just like passing through. So it's, it was very difficult to design a place that would sustain itself without somebody passionate driving it. The owners were definitely passionate about it, but I'm not trying to like teach them how to run the restaurant. You know, that's not. So I just looked at like what was good on their menu. And they had a lot of good Chinese dishes. I was like, don't touch that. Just leave that there and let's build on it with what you think will pull people in here. And they're like, well, what do you like to cook? So I gave them a couple of like Vietnamese recipes. You know, I gave them a, I was like really into like smoking and barbecuing meats there. So I was like, I put like some ribs on their menu. But so it was like, we were like, oh, so the one common denominator in all of this is like pork. So we opened Grumpy Pig, which was like a pork centric restaurant. So we had like pork ramen, tonkatsu, like pork street toast, pork summer rolls, ribs, like a you know a pulled pork sandwich. It was
pork
cool.
Is arguably, I mean, I go back and forth every day on what I enjoy eating, but like pork might be my favorite. Like. Thing to eat in all of those forms you just said.
Yeah.
Obviously, the pork chop.
And now, that, now I'm going to get you on the pork soup dumplings.
Was, yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you because, especially starting to cook again now, for, especially like in LA where there's a how much does dietary people's dietary restrictions and people's like I don't know, like even just the vegan vegetarian like. Yeah. Cooking pork so good, but like I can't go on Instagram without people being like, here's you murdering pigs because you fucking like bacon sandwiches.
Yeah.
Like how much is that a factor into you, like how you approach things in, okay. in well, cooking food?
I think people's dietary choices are theirs and like I respect them. I always have. That's why like people called out the fact that half of, the, I mean, every dish at Silent H had a vegetarian option for it. Like, in a serious one, too, you know? Even though...
You're not just taking the meat out of something.
Yeah, exactly. I'm, like, you know, putting fried bean curd in its place that I have to, like, go all the way to Chinatown and pick up, you know, really good stuff. And, yeah, so... I always respect it. I always have that in mind, but it never deters me from like cooking something that I think people there's an appreciation for. I haven't really come across an ingredient or a dish that I've wanted to make that was so out there. You know, my lane has kind of always been like I trip over something that I really like or really love and I kind of immerse myself in it and, mm-hmm. and then kind of like learn that way. So like Chinese food, it's been like almost like a year now. So like you got to try the pork soup dumplings that I made, the shun
soup
bao.
Dumplings are like one of my favorite things to eat. And when I watched you make it for the, like I had never understood it in the first place. I'm like, how does the liquid, How is it wet when I open it up? Like how do they get that in there and close the dumpling?
Yeah. It's like cooking a lot of pork skin and then having this like rock hard pork skin gelatin. So that's it. Like that all that richness comes from the skin. And then, you know, my buddy Gary in Shanghai taught me how to make his favorite Shunjin Bao. He like took my business partners and I through a tour. Just imagine. One of the best tours is like, and then he's like yelling at you, don't eat more than one. Trust me. We got to try some more. And it's like,
because you had so many different ones to eat.
Yeah. And I was like, the first one I wanted to eat like 8 of them. And he's like, no. It's like, we get on the subway. And it's like, and then like, it's like,
and where was that?
This is all in Shanghai. Like our last trip was in December. And then like all my friends all had their opinions of like what the best ones were. And then like, so I started working on them, and then Gary kind of like helped me like across the finish line. And he's like, dude, you got to take the, so you buy basically like you get the pork skin and you take out all the fat and you render that until it almost like caramel, it almost like starts to smoke a little bit.
Well, I mean, I think of rendering as like my porn when I was 16 starting to like unfold on the screen in a cooking sense.
Pixelated.
Yeah. What is rendering?
Oh, so you're just like
cooking, I can't go. My porn's still rendering.
You're cooking, melting it down. You know, yeah. Like that soft, almost like muscular, like fat. Basically just, you sweat it out. And one of the parts that you don't use, so you take all that beautiful, it's like, so you're familiar with brown butter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you take butter and you like put on,
I know,
some
butter
heat.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, you heat it up and like you basically like get them, you cook the milk solids and they like caramelize and you get this sweet rich brown butter. So you're kind of doing the same thing with the pork fat, and you use that brown butter of pork fat with the gelatin and the pork, and like gives you your soup dumpling. And it's very lightly seasoned with ginger and white pepper. There's like no big secret, right? It's just super labor intensive, and it's been like my kryptonite. It's like the one hurdle that will forever haunt me, and like I really want to nail it. It's just like I kind of feel like I could throw down like 1,000 reps of anything else.
Right.
Vietnamese curry, just doing, but like, it's just so tedious.
It seems like a fool's errand to pick something so difficult.
It's kind of crazy.
I mean, you're only going to sell them for $2.50.
No, that depends on the neighborhood.
Right. Yeah. So you guys.
And I'll get, yeah, if I do 250 dumpling, like, it would be like 1-star reviews. Like, Asian people just like cry bloody murder, you know? But yeah, that's going to be good stuff.
So you're simultaneously trying to perfect that and look for a place to put it.
Yeah.
And what do you look for? I mean, obviously, when you think of like restaurants and real estate, you're like, hey, something cheap in a great area that was like already has the kitchen I need would be.
Yeah.
But like what specifically where and like what's going to be the one that makes you pull the trigger?
Well, I'm not schizophrenic. When I say we, I have like two partners.
Yeah.
We don't see eye to eye on everything. So everything's kind of like a compromise or a process, if you will. So like I personally would love to be, this sounds really bad, but like the tip of the spear in gentrifying a neighborhood.
Right.
But I mean, it's not like I want to gentrify neighborhoods, but I kind of want to be like,
you want to be ahead of the curve.
Yeah, I don't want to be like what, like buying into like what Williamsburg is now, you know?
Right.
You're talking about like Whole Foods and Apple stores opening up and stuff. Nothing against that. It's just like the reality of it is
the reality is that people
pay that premium.
Yeah, and people had restaurants for 50 years on Abbot Kinney and they can't afford the rent. So
exactly.
Why would I want to jump into that water?
Yeah. And it's crazy. It's like, and it's actually, we all pay that rent because the customer has to pay for that too, you know? Like, it's like right now current market is like $8 a square foot per month is what you're looking to pay for rent. So 1,000 square feet, let's imagine a 30 seater with the, you know, that's like $8,000 a month in rent that you have to pay, and it's like, that's a lot of dumplings.
What about like my favorite place to eat right now?
Yeah.
Is the corner of Lincoln and Brooks. Is a taco stand. These guys roll the cart out.
Yeah,
it's a
yeah.
dollar taco.
Yeah.
It's $5 burritos. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a trend in LA, like for going back, you know, however long, 10 years now and more, like the food truck, the do the one thing you do and just bring it everywhere for people.
Yeah.
What is there a temptation to do to get into that world?
You know, it comes up. That notion comes up a lot, you know. I always think it's like something, it's a commitment to do that. I mean, you obviously are committed to, you know, your podcast and your comedy and stuff. You know, I would like to say I am the same about my cooking and stuff, but I'm married now and stuff, and I don't want to be like selling dumplings at like, you know, 1 a.m. on a street, like, to drunk people.
Yeah, well, what, I mean, but when you think about it, right, in a perfect world, you find a place, it's so happening.
People already know about me.
And people already
on a cart, spinning them out. I would love that. Yeah. Hell yeah, man. Sell out by three, go home, hang out with everybody. Like, that'd be awesome. Yeah. That would be a dream job. Have like, yeah.
Well,
wake
when
up at eight, make dumplings.
Can we just make a deal where if, you know, when you get the restaurant going, I can pull up in an Airstream that's already got your logo on it and just take a bunch and sell them for you?
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
What's the best and what's the worst part of working in just restaurants, the food industry?
For me right now, it changes, depends on like when you ask me, you know, what age. It used to be, I would say like the hardest part were the hours, you know, we kind of have, nocturnal hours, and that doesn't always coincide with friends and family, you know, and, holidays and all that stuff. And that never changes. You just learn how to adopt that life and have a balanced life, right? So now this, like, I've been, like, cooking for 13 years. I still don't know what comfortable, if there's such thing as a comfortable kitchen shoes.
Yeah.
You know, like, Danskos, Birkenstocks, Crocs. It's like, dude. So anyways, my point being, like, the standing and I'm getting old, man. Like, my back hurts, you know?
I mean,
that shiatsu thing from Costco.
Shiatsu beanbag.
Yeah.
I think the answer is like you just got to go all in on like the $180 Air Max Nike, like get the runner shoe. The thing that
if they allowed me to like not slip across the floor,
right?
I'd be down.
That's the most important thing, right? Is the non-slip bottom.
Yeah. Until you go home, your back's broken. You're like, I rather would have like slipped. Just learn how to slip and land on my knees.
What's the best part?
The best part? Oh man, I would say, not to sound cheesy, but whatever, I'm cheesy, is like meeting people like you, like my friends, you know, like, there's a lot of you guys now in LA, dude. It's really cool. Like, I saw my friend Rick last night from New York. It's being able to see my friends at work. I think that's like the coolest thing about
people want to come see you.
Yeah.
The food, obviously, we've talked about it. We loved the Silent H food. It was like, again, changed my culinary world. Yeah. But like, it's coming in the chef and the owner coming out and saying like, this is why I did this and this is what.
Yeah.
And you go like, oh man, like I feel like my friend is the chef of a restaurant.
It's weird because I think my the valiant qualities to have as a chef is like both like kind of like domesticated like traits, like, you know, like learning how to clean up after people, you know, learning how to feed people, you know, like they're kind of like very familial things. And then the other part, because you are creating something, is like the show part of it, you know, the music, the lights, like the, you know, the vibe, the attitude and stuff. That's all like super important. I mean, and also like you can't control all those things either. You know, like the culture at Silent H was just like the culture of that neighborhood, and it just kind of like,
you can set up what you want your place to be, but the people who come in are going to determine.
I mean, I had a logo. I had kitchen sketched out. I didn't know what it was going to look like. People came in and were like, let's build this. Do you remember how stupid high my bar was? It's like you had to be at least 6 foot tall.
It was perfect for me. I thought it was fantastic.
Enjoy it.
I'm 6 foot four. I'm like, finally a bar my size. How dare the rest of you people not do it like this?
I mean, definitely one of the scariest moments of my restaurant life was when a woman
fell
off the stool backwards and like stumbled and kicked the front door. She almost like had so much momentum. She almost kicked the front
went
door.
Out the front, went out those glass.
Not funny. I don't know why I'm like laughing now.
Because she's everybody's okay.
Everyone's okay. And it was like years ago. I waited. But she almost kicked. She almost like rolled out onto the street. Like
one, like you're with the new project. Is it, do you call it a project?
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
See, I'm your guys totally are. It's the new project you're working on.
New band.
Just like anything though, especially in art, you have to have, I feel like, the social media presence. The,
oh yeah, suck it.
Like, you know, you got to do the Facebook, the Instagram story, and
oh God, it's so hard.
And food, even, I mean, food was like the reason Instagram made it.
Yeah.
People taking pictures of their food.
Yeah.
How do you feel about like Instagram food culture?
Oh man, I totally am addicted to Instagram. I think like this month there was like a week where I was lucky enough not to like just look at it, but it's kind of how I am spoon fed so many things, work related, just, and at the same time is also how I like kind of like relax and uncharge, you know, go down for the night when I'm on Instagram.
Yeah.
But now, like you said, like, you know, I'm looking at other chefs and other restaurants and other brands that are starting up. They're doing stories and they're like, have you seen this trend lately? It's like, oh, I'm making pho right now. Like, do you like your pho with like bone marrow? Yes or no? And
yeah,
then it's like, and I was like, I feel that pressure. Like I have to do something like that for Stay Lucky, but like, I don't have that talent, you know, like I'm trying to record my cooking and it's like, all you see are my hands, or like it's out of frame. And it's like, anybody that knows me knows like I suck at that stuff, you know? I can't take a good picture, my handshake. So yeah, I can't, I mean, I think I have like funny ideas for it, but it's kind of, it's hard. It's hard to be the one making the food and create content.
Right.
I don't understand how people in kitchens can do all that stuff with one hand and stuff. Like
you know, everybody's got a social media coordinator, yeah, you know, like it, even the best Instagram story, it's like it's planned, yeah, it's rostered, but there is something to you being like, I do the cooking.
Yeah.
Somebody's got to handle that.
Yeah.
But what about Instagram food culture? Like when you're making food, and especially like, I'm sure it was even happening while Silent H was open, like the taking a picture, like somebody's food, you serve somebody their food and then, yeah, like they take out their phone.
Yeah.
How, like, is that, as the person who's the chef who made that food, does that make you feel good, bad, indifferent? You're like, yeah, please post it for, so people come.
Yeah, I don't, nothing I've cooked really has been like, you have to eat it before the cone evaporates.
Right.
Cause I breathe this ice cone for you with my liquid nitrogen. No, I mean, nothing's that fragile. It's like, let people enjoy the food the way they want to enjoy it. It's like, just don't waste food. Actually, like, the only thing I hate about, you know, like, I'm sure people are entitled to send whatever they want back to the kitchen. You know, the contract is like, I'm going to make you food and you pay for it. That's the agreement. But sometimes, like, people, like, send food back for, like, very subtle reasons. And like, that food oftentimes goes in the trash. And I just think like, it's, if people knew that, they wouldn't, you know, they'd be a little bit, maybe they wouldn't do that. I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think, I don't think that's something that even the type of person that sends food back,
yeah,
which I would never, like, I can't, it would have to be really bad. You,
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
I would have to be like, I feel like I might get sick eating this,
yeah,
or I asked for something that I was allergic,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
to not have it in here because, yeah, I'm allergic to it. So the people that think it's okay to even send something, yeah, back are the people that aren't considering that it's going in the trash.
Right, right. I mean, it's like kind of an unspoken law, right? But I guess legally you're entitled to.
Right. And I think there's also, you know, what's funny, we're talking about the comparisons to other, to being a musician, to being a comedian or whatever. You do have lives.
Take
in your
that hand. Song back.
You do
Fuck
have
that
you do have lives in your hand. Like there's people that can get sick. There's people who can,
oh,
you know,
oh,
like
my
that's.
God. I was just like, I got food poisoning on Monday, and like by Wednesday, like I felt like I couldn't breathe. Like I was like, those muscles were so exhausted from driving, dude. Like I always said, like if I were a Marvel supervillain, like my power would be like to give you food. Like I would be able to fuck with your digestion, like,
yeah,
give you food poisoning.
You're just gonna,
like,
shit and puke, you know, for,
yeah,
3 days.
Yeah.
Good luck fighting in Infinity
like,
War.
Lift a train, yeah, yeah. I don't care if you lift a train when you're busy like shitting your brains out. You know, it's like, yeah, I take like the safety of food very seriously. Even like, doing my pop-ups at Mandrake the other day, like people were like, damn, you got like pretty serious setup. I was like,
I said that it looks like a, you know, the bomb in an action movie that has to be diffused. Yeah. So it's like a lot of different running numbers and boiling.
Oh yeah.
Things.
I actually had that's my 8-phase timer. Cause I have to cook different noodles and wontons at different times and they go in the water.
It looks like
times.
The panel in the DeLorean and Back to the Future.
Yeah. No, that's, there's a reason. My friend's actually writing a book about this right now. The DOH and stuff, chefs, like your gripes with them, whatever. I mean, there's definitely a need for kitchen sanitation and safety. I'm a big stickler for it personally, but like some of those like the inspections and how they tax you and stuff is a little kind of like detrimental to businesses sometimes.
What's the most underrated food? What's the most overrated food?
Underrated food. I gotta say, like, Indonesian food.
When's is the most underrated?
Indonesian and Filipino food.
What's a standard dish? What's the underrated food? You're like, okay, it's underrated. What should I be eating more of?
Oh man. So I'm just thinking with like Filipino and Indonesian food, like they're just kind of like their curried or stewed proteins. Like in Indonesian food, rendang, beef rendang, like someone was talking to me about like how come it's a dish that most traveled or people like have traveled and stuff like can identify because it's in Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore and stuff. Like how come that hasn't really become a trend in like cities like New York and LA? Or there's always like one or two options and stuff. And then you look at Korean and it's like, it's pretty vast. Chinese, Japanese, Thai, the same, you know, even Vietnamese now it's getting more popular. So I think it's underrated. Like I mentioned, I used to work at Selma Pagi. Like that was like a dish that I never got sick of, like personally eating. Like anytime like you make something, like I could not eat a banh mi for like 3 years after Silent Age, you know, it's like so over it. But that's I think the most underrated. It's just like it's very specific. Like you want to go eat rice with like some saucy curries and stuff, and like there's still like lots of color and herbs and stuff in it. It's like if you like Vietnamese food, it's very like it's almost like kind of automatic that you can get into Indonesian food. So we should check that out. I used to order some. I think there's a place by you actually on the west side that's pretty good. I have to ask Julia the name. She would always order it for me.
I know it's some overrated food.
Fuck, dude. Give me an example of an overrated food that you...
I don't know. Like foie gras.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see.
Or like... I don't know. Something that people make a big deal out of.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I love lobster. And
lobster's definitely... I've said that to my family... For my entire life, lobster is so overrated.
I feel like lobster might be in my last meal. Like I might do a surf and turf with like a butter, like a blue cheese butter situation over, or your pork chop.
Yeah.
But like, it's still overrated because it's, you know, when you go to restaurant, you're like, you fucking ordered the lobster, really?
Yeah.
Like you had to be the guy. I guess it's like overrated in a price sense. It's overrated in like a when you should be ordering it sense.
I mean, it's like, it's super expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked at a lobster place for a year as my last job in New York, so I know why lobsters are expensive. There's a true cost to everything. But even my entire life, it's been like something like my family splurges on. And it's like, God, we get splurged in so many. That resource or that value isn't there for me. The payoff isn't good enough. You know, I thought when you said overrated, I thought you meant something like, you know, I was thinking more like something like, oh, like the whole pizza, like brick oven pizza thing, you know?
That could be overrated too.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like it's overrated. Like I don't enjoy it, but like, I think the last time I was visiting Charleston, South Carolina, like my buddy owns Shabba Biscuit and Two down there. And his partner Joey was telling me like they're opening 3 like you know, Roberta's-esque or like Pizza Bianco-esque kind of like pizzas. Oh, I got a question for you.
Sure.
Can we talk about, what's your favorite pizza in New York?
My favorite pizza in New York. Oof, that's so tough. Man.
Or, yeah, where would you go to if you're,
like Joe's Pizza in the Village, like if I'm going to like just get a slice.
Yeah.
Pretty, like a New York slice, I just want it to be like, I almost want it to be like unexceptional.
Yeah.
Like don't take it too seriously. It's it is what it is, but like, you know, there is obviously with pizza, like too much cheese, too much bread. Like Joe's knows what they're doing. Yeah. So they're there for a slice. And then actually it's like 2-3 blocks away even, but like John's Pizza, which is I think on Bleecker right there as well. Then it's
is
like
that just because you're like a comedian and you have to hang out there and
I don't know. It's just like, that's what I think of when I think of like, oh, I'm going to get a slice of pizza. And that's what I'm going to think if I'm going to get like sit down and like be like, hey, let's all meet out somewhere for pizza.
Yeah.
Then like, I mean, it's, well, you got Grimaldi's and you
have you been, how about Ruby Rosa? Have you been there?
I haven't.
So good.
I like, that what's the Speedy one that's Romeo. Out? What's the one that's out? I love it. It's like the cheeseless one where, God, why am I, Spumoni Gardens.
Yes.
I do love that. That's like,
I only had it once.
You feel like you're doing a different kind of pizza, but like, I'll also, that's a destination pizza for me. Like, I'll get in my car and drive out to Spumoni Garden and, like, get that pizza.
Did you have a car in New York?
I did for a while. Oh, cool. I had my Cadillac, but then, like, parking tickets will ruin your fucking life in New York.
Oh, man. It's a big old car, too.
I was saying my last meal might include your pork chop. What, you open a restaurant, okay? Let's knock on wood, this doesn't happen, but you open a restaurant, you don't cook a chicken properly. Somebody dies. Judge Gordon Ramsay sentences you to death.
Uh-huh.
It's the night before you're going to be executed for your kitchen crime.
Yeah.
What's your last meal?
Oh, man. Yeah, but I think I would have to pick like a sushi omakase or something cheesy like that. If I'm just like, I don't know, like, is it like when you're about to die, do you want to just be like, yeah, this is really, really fucking good, yum, and then you die? Or do you want to like revisit something nostalgic and say something, answer something sweet like my mom's pork chop and rice, you know, like.
I don't know. That's why I asked you.
Yeah, I think I would just go for the omakase. Because you know what? Like, I eat my mom's thing in like 20 minutes and the omakase will like last me 3 hours. So I get to live for an extra 2 hours and 40 minutes.
What does that even entail?
Oh, dude. So did I ever take you to my friend's place at 108 Kazu when he was like behind the sushi counter there? So he just like does these like, I don't know. It's just like he's just got the magic touch, in my opinion. Like he just makes you go wow with every little bite. I'm talking about like 2-bite pieces. His sushi pieces are extraordinarily small.
Mm-hmm.
But they're just perfect bites of food. And like, the reason it's so beautiful too is just like the fish is just like, you're watching him make stuff, you know, like with his hands, he's forming, he's cutting it, he's torching it, he's squeezing, he's brushing soy sauce on it. It's just like a really cool experience, you know? So yeah, that'd be kind of cool for a last meal.
Have you been to Go's Mart?
Uh-uh.
That's like the sushi place that I went here that was like mind blowing. It's in like Canoga Park
in an
old like video store.
Oh shit.
And I went in the back and the guy was like, no soy sauce with this. And I was
okay.
And it was like gold. And I was like, what am I eating?
Yeah.
It was like, and it was incredibly expensive and I didn't know what to do, but it was like phenomenal.
I want to go check it out with you.
Yeah. Great. Cause I was like, I was hoping that you were like, yes, that's the best, but not knowing about it.
No, I have a note. Yeah. So this guy Kazu, he also like, one time Julie and I were in Tokyo and he was like, do you want to go eat at my uncle's restaurant? And I was like, oh shit. I remembered him telling me this one. He like on Facebook, he was like, you want to go eat at my uncle's? I remember him telling me a long time ago that his uncle was, have you seen that documentary, Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
Yeah.
His uncle, it's his uncle's hands making the sushi in the movie. It's not
It's not Jiro.
It's not actually Jiro. Sometimes it's Jiro, but there's...
He's Jiro's stunt hand.
He's Jiro. He was Jiro's first a right-hand man, basically.
And left-hand man for the movie.
He's the both-hand man. Yeah, because the movie is all about like him giving the restaurant to his two sons, but it's Jiro's original, and then his youngest son has another one. But then there's the second one, the one in between is Kazu's uncle's. So he's like, finds me on Facebook, and he's like, let's go. I was like, dude, we get to go to this Michelin star omakase, and it's Julie's birthday. I was like, taking her there for her as her birthday present. We get the concierge like gives us directions, which we hand to a taxi driver. He gets us there, and he like points up. We go up this elevator. It's in this mall. We basically get off on the 8th floor, and we're in like women's night, like evening gowns and stuff. So we're just walking through like the women's like department of like a Japanese Macy's or something. And then there's like a tiny little curtain at the back, and you walk in, and it's like the size of this living room. It's like super intimate, like no music, nothing. Just like this old dude back there. Don't speak any English. It's like five customers in the whole place. And we're just like, show him this piece of paper, like, Kodasai, sorry, excuse me, please, like, read this. And it's like, oh yeah, we've been expecting you. Cool. And they just start us. Mill was amazing. I still like his nephew's style a little bit more, but Michelin star. Or super expensive meal. It was 18 minutes.
What?
Yeah.
You were in and out 18 minutes?
Yeah. He's so fast. He's so fast. There's just no time to like kick back and like chill, nothing. And you see it on the... And anybody that's been to Jiro's, like, yeah, it's... My one friend said it best. He's like, it's the most expensive restaurant in the world per minute. It's like, I think it's like $500 a head.
Wow.
Yeah.
You don't even get a half hour in there.
Thank God we got a discount.
Yeah, but since you talked about where's a place that people should go to eat, I'm not talking about a restaurant. I'm saying like if somebody was into culinary tourism, where would you recommend somebody go if they just wanted to spend a week eating?
Dude, it's hands down Tokyo. You know, we were just in Sayulita, amazing Mexican food, agua chile, ceviche, tacos, and stuff. But it, you know, if you're going for an eating tour, you go to Tokyo, you might even find like, they might have Sayulita tacos there by now. I don't know, but they fetishize food in a way that in these really charming, like cool, like neighborhoods that you can just kind of explore, you'll find like little gems that serve everything from Italian food to like very specific, like specializations in like a Japanese dish, you know, from ramen to like soba noodles or to tempuras, and like so I would recommend going there. And if you're ever interested, I actually got a buddy who does an Airbnb there. He's actually from Shanghai, but he like retired from DJing, and now he just has two Airbnbs that he takes care of in Tokyo. And like him and his wife have made this book. It's like, oh, go check out this. Walk down this alley, turn in here, and like you'll find like a all vinyl like record bar. They spin records all night. Speakeasy. It's like, oh man, yeah. You can really get just delve into like it's like one stop shopping in a way. But like something about Tokyo is also it's like legitimately delicious. If you go during the right time where the exchange rate works in your favor, you'll feel like you're getting a really good deal. It could be pricey, it could be like super cheap for whatever you're like. You gotta try their pork sandwiches. This is like white bread with breaded pork cutlet in it.
Sounds delicious.
But they it has to be a very specific part of the pork because there's always this like bonus piece of like pork fat on the corner. It's like tonkatsu.
Yeah,
it's like breaded with like fresh Wonder Bread breadcrumbs, then put there's a barbecue sauce on it, and then like white bread, and that's it. And it's like,
well, we'll wrap up now because I'm getting hungry.
All right.
Couple last thing, and then I want you to tell everybody about Stay Lucky more so that people can find it and do it.
Okay.
What's the first? I mean, I feel like this is the most telling thing about. I can't think of like a more high pressure situation for a chef.
Yeah.
What's the first thing that you made for your wife?
Oh, fuck, man.
You like ramen out of the bag?
That's probably breakfast. Yeah. Man, I was in Shanghai. Well, I know exactly what it is. Technically, she came to Grumpy Pig. So she came to my restaurant. And specifically because I invited her. This is like right when we started dating. Like she came, it's like there's a season in Shanghai called Hairy Crab Season. And yeah, it's very.
It's when you find your wife.
It's when you find your wife. It's low tide. You find your wife. No, but like it's something to do with like the lunar tides and stuff. And like the crabs like come out and they just harvest them. And they're all like ripe and ready, full of roe and stuff. And the whole country just goes wild over them. So we had like we cooked the local chef there, Chef Rocky. They all have English names. It's a Chinese guy named Rocky.
Yeah.
Him and I, like, and Gary, like, we cooked this, like, 12-course hairy crab meal. It was really good. And that was, like, how I got...
and she came, and that was what you were serving that evening.
Yeah, she came, and, like, yeah, it was... That's officially the first time she, like, ate my food.
Ate your food.
Yeah, or, like, I cooked knowing she was going to eat it. Yeah.
Well, dude, thank you for sitting down and talking about
it. My pleasure, man.
So right now, Stay Lucky is the pop-up at Mandrake Bar.
Yeah.
You guys do it every Thursday.
Every Thursday from 5:30 to 10, yeah.
And it's your super soft for a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah.
And the restaurant will be called Stay Lucky. Is that the plan?
It's called Stay Lucky, yeah. Okay.
Instagram is...
Eat, drink, stay lucky.
Eat, drink, stay lucky.
Yeah,
we're gonna get your social media game.
Yeah,
flowing.
I got one outlet and one campfire stove at Mandrake. So I'm boiling dumplings and I'm deep frying chicken wings, but it's good.
Dude, the chicken wings that was the thing that really blew me away the last time I ate them. Like the last time when we visited you there, like I love dumplings. I could eat a million dumplings. Yeah. Like when you post just. You know, a pile of dumplings.
Yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
Oh God, I gotta go eat fucking dumplings. Yeah. But you know, we ordered one of everything that you were making.
I think that was fun, and
I was like, we gotta get more chicken wings.
Yeah,
what's in that chicken wing? What do you got going on there?
Oh man, it's just like a really nice seasoned dredge, and you know, just basically, I think like my experience
that means
with,
nothing to me. A seasoned dredge.
So
I'm thinking about you pulling them out of a lake.
Yeah, so that style of wing represents like for me the style of wing where chicken where you're just it's just like juicy chicken with crispy skin. It doesn't have that extra like KFC for example. It's like a battered chicken,
right?
So it's a wet batter. So this one is just dredged, which means it's just like seasoned flour and it's just like without any buttermilk or any egg or anything. It's just like a you throw it in there. It's a little the wing's a little moist. The skin picks up this highly seasoned flour, and we deep fry that. So, basically, eating crispy like seasoned crispy skin, and they're just addictive, man.
So addictive.
Yeah. So it's just like, and it, the first time I made them, like, I think you guys got to eat them at my old apartment. That was like still the best because I still had these peppercorns from that chef I was telling you about, Yubo. But when he took us around Chengdu, he let me buy chili flakes there, but he's like, don't even buy Sichuan peppercorns. Like these are good. But he gave me like a vacuum pack, snuck back like a bag of like peppercorns that he like vacuum packed for me saying like, these are amazing. And like, if I open that bag up, you'll probably smell it like a block away. It's so fragrant.
It's like
amazing.
The briefcase in Pulp Fiction.
What is that gold? Oh, it's vacuum sealed peppercorns.
Yeah. So at Eat Drink Stay Lucky, follow it, and then
when come by, have a beer, come to the backyard and order some food. And
I by the way, I don't mind at all. Like I'm a truck guy. I'm either the side of the street. I love going obviously to the back of a cocktail bar and eating your dumplings and wings and wontons. If somebody was like a patron, like if I'm going, when is Vin having a restaurant? When do you think I'll be sitting in something?
Oh, okay. To that, like, early next year. Yeah.
Well, can't wait. Everybody follow Vin. Thank you for sitting down.
Thank you for always, like, yeah, dude, being a fanboy and always like coming to eat the food. Dude.
I'm a fucking fat piece of shit, bro. I love it. I love
supporting me, dude. That's awesome.
It's fun because like I hate the term foodie. I think it's like the dumbest thing. We're all foodies, right? Sure, we all got to fucking eat. But like I do enjoy going to like I make food a destination. Like if I go too long, I'll just be like, I'm driving to downtown. I'm getting Philippe's with like, you know, a pickled egg and like a side of pie. Yeah. Like I get.
You go by yourself even?
The time I'll be like have a craving for something and be like, I'm just going, you know, there's something about eating that when you know what you want to eat and then you go get it, you feel like you're truly satisfied as opposed to like what's in the freezer. And, I've always just been a fan of your food. Like it's on that.
Thank you.
You know, I haven't seen you in a while too. It's like nice to have you back and be like, oh, you're cooking stuff. I'll go eat that every.
I mean, you lucked out because like I'm always gonna want to like the first thing I offer when you like came in, I was like eventually when I was like, dude, you want some dumplings, whatever.
Well, then that's the last thing I'm asking because I keep talking about it. Like I just think of what you've gone through in cooking and restauranting and on the same timeline. Like I really feel like, man, I watch a guy do what I'm doing in stand-up comedy and food. And it's like, so that's also why I want to support.
Yeah.
But like people always go like, tell me a joke.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Do people is the first thing somebody's like, make me fucking dumplings.
Yeah.
Is it all?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Give me 10 minutes. No, it'll take me 10 minutes, but you want me to make you some real quick?
No. I was more asking as like in terms of like, does it get annoying when people go cook for me?
No, no one does that. I'm probably going to offer before you have to ask.
Well then fucking make some dumplings.
Yeah, all right, cool.
Hey Joe, I like Joe's show. I tell everybody that's my shit. See, I had a long ride, turn the volume up high and the time flew by so quick. I laughed out loud, that's what it's about. I really don't feel safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause he drinks till he hits the flow. Hey Joe, it's time to stop the show. Pack it up and away we go. Donate cause we